This is New Hampshire Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. What does it mean to be stateless? For New Hampshire's Bhutanese community, it's meant being forced off land and stripped of citizenship by a government in Bhutan that's decided their Nepali language and Hindu religion were no longer welcome in Buddhist-majority Bhutan. It's meant fleeing the country they've called home their entire lives and moving to overcrowded refugee camps in Nepal. It's meant waiting at those camps sometimes for decades while the international community tried to find a permanent solution. And with no resolution in sight and returning home off the table, being stateless has meant starting over, resettling in new places, bringing new opportunities, but also new challenges. Over the past few years, hundreds of Bhutanese people have resettled in the Granite State, making up New Hampshire's largest community of refugees, and they're telling their stories, too, about the pain of exile, the difficulties of life in refugee camps, the ups and downs of resettlement in the United States, and hopes for the future, both here and in their native country. Today on The Exchange, the stories of the Bhutanese, the state's largest refugee group. And we'd like to hear from you, too. Do you know a Bhutanese family in New Hampshire? What more would you like to know about their culture or their history? Call in The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or The Exchange page at nhpr.org. Our guest this hour, Tika Acharya. He's executive director and founder of the Bhutanese Community of New Hampshire. It's a nonprofit that provides direct services helping with the resettlement of refugees. Tika, it's great to have you here.
My pleasure.
We're also joined by Narad Adhikari. He arrived in Manchester in 2011 under the resettlement program with his wife and children, hosted by the International Institute of New England. Narad, it's great to meet you.
Thank you very much.
We're also joined by Bill Gillett. He's chairman of the International Institute of New England, which is a nonprofit organization that helps to resettle refugees and immigrants in the region. Bill, nice to have you.
Good morning. Thank you, Brady.
Let's start with you, Tika. How old were you when you first started to hear about this new policy in Bhutan that started this whole process off in the late 80s, early 90s? I believe it's called One Nation, One People. How old were you when you first started to hear about this policy and these changes that were going on in your country?
I left. I had to leave the country at the age of 13. And when I was in the school at around 10 or 11 years old, you know, we heard a lot about what's going on in the country. And, you know, at the age of probably, 12 or 13, I really understood what's going to happen. So I was maybe around 11 and 12 years old when I heard about it.
So still fairly young, but old enough that you could start to understand a little bit that things were changing and that things were going to be different for you in the future.
Yeah, but that time we were not aware. We were trying to listen to what my parents and other elders would say and then just to follow them because it was not clear. We were in the villages in this school in Bhutan and we're not exposed to television, telephone, television, no media, nothing. So just bounded by, a small group of people and we just have to follow them.
And what were your parents and elders in your community saying at that point? Were they still hoping that things were going to change and that there wouldn't be a need to leave the country? Or was there a growing recognition that the outlook for the future is not good and they were going to have to start making different plans?
I would remember only the great fear in the family and in the community. Every, the house, the neighbor, on the other side of our house, they used to come and talk to our dad, what's going to happen, it's fear, other places from other part of the village, they were arrested, some of them killed. These were the things that I used to hear. And then, my father was, in fact, one of the victims, and he was arrested and put in the prison for 1.5 years and tortured. So that was all the fear that I could remember at that point of time.
Now, how old were you when your father was arrested and tortured?
12 years old.
So and that was then what? So you were still in the country at that point.
I was in the country, and in fact, I had to take a lot of responsibilities at the age of 12 when my mother was crying and my grandmother was crying at home, and my sisters were really little. They were, I think, 3-4 years old. And then I was the only one that could understand a little bit, you know, outside. So it was a huge responsibility at that point of time to, to conceal. And at one point of time, we heard that my father was killed in the jail. So it was all, you know, hue and cry at it in the family. So that was, you know, that was what happened at the age of 12.
That's a lot to have on your shoulders at age 12. Now, Narad, you were a bit older when all of this started to happen in your country. I think you were in your 20s, is that right?
Yes, I was 26 years old.
And can you tell us a little bit about what you were hearing at that stage? What were you hearing from about what was going on and what it might mean for you?
Well, I was, excuse me, I was 26 years at the time when this problem started. But there were a lot of rumors going on about the implementation of One Nation, One People policy, which means the dress code, language code, religion code. Bhutan is the Buddhist country, and the king wanted only Buddhism to be practiced. So people were very much concerned about that. Unlike the other countries, ours is a very confined, it's a very closed society. We don't have any open media or any means to raise our concern publicly. So people were not finding any mechanism or any challenge to hear their voice, hear their grievances. So I heard that when the One Nation, One People policy was implemented, one woman in Chirang district, one of the southern district, committed suicide. So that news came to the king, and king sent one of the royal advisory counselors, who was also from southern Bhutan, to find the report about that, the ground situation, why the lady committed suicide. So after that, when he came back to Thimphu and submitted the report, that report was taken as not review on the report, but immediately take the action that the royal advisory counselor was planning some political plot against the king, and he was terminated from the services, and he was removed from the post. He was sent 3 days in the jail, and then he has to go back to home. So that created a lot of tension among the educated people from the southern community, where the majority of whom were Hindus and ethnic Nepali community. So that started the situation getting more and more serious, and ultimately, when our voice, our appeal, were not heard by the king, then the people started getting together, especially in the night, because during the day it was very difficult. And in finally, in September, October 1990, they organized the peaceful appeal hoping that their voice would be heard by the king. But that was taken at advantage by the king. Immediately he sent deployed the armies to the whole six districts of the southern Bhutan, where ethnic Nepali, who are called Lhochampas, were residing in majority. So when the armies were deployed, the situation became horrible. There was torture, rape, killing, looting, everything started. So that was very, very difficult for the innocent ethnic Nepali to find the security or to ensure living a peaceful life. So ultimately, they were compelled to find the means of survival, and they have to leave from the country.
And so what became sort of a peaceful appeal wound up being an opportunity for the armies to come in. There was violence, and that's what started people fleeing.
Absolutely.
To the country. When did you leave Bhutan?
I lived in 1991, September. The problem started in 1990, September, officially. And in 1 year, after 1 year, I tried to stay back in Thimphu. I was in the capital of Thimphu. I was a fresh graduate from the university and studied in India. I was working with the Special Commission for Cultural Affairs, which was working especially to implement the One Nation, One People policy. I was one of the staffs to do the translation work of the Buddhist script to the Nepali or Sanskrit to make the Hindu community to understand about Buddhism, because King wanted to tell to the people that Buddhism and Hinduism doesn't have different, but for the people who do not have the education, it was a vast different.
So you had been working for the government during this time when it was implementing a policy that was directly targeting your community. That must have been incredibly difficult.
It was very difficult. It was very, very painful. But under the law of the land, under the law of the king, anybody speaking or anybody opined against the policy of the king is termed as an act of treason. So I was fearing to face the treasonous act if action by the government if I don't listen or obey the order from the king. So I was just following the instruction.
Bill, how characteristic are these two stories from what you've heard of people who have come to New Hampshire? Is this the typical course of events? You start to hear rumors in a town, maybe from family members, and then after a time, as the conflict between these two groups starts to intensify, people start to have to take desperate measures, fleeing the country or facing very serious difficulties.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's very typical of the types of stories that you hear, and it always begins with uncertainty, and then it moves to a situation in which people have to flee very quickly. There's tremendous fear in the community. As both Tika and Narad have pointed out, the communication, the ability to communicate among villages and that was very limited in Bhutan, and that fuels that fear and uncertainty of what's happening.
And that's something that I'm sure sticks with people even to this day, that people can very vividly remember those days in the early 1990s when they had to make these decisions so quickly.
Yeah, everyone has very specific stories and very specific recollections of that time.
You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Today we're talking about the stories of the Bhutanese in the Granite State. For the past few years, they've been New Hampshire's largest refugee group, with more arriving annually. We're exploring their journeys from nearly 20 years in refugee camps to their challenges and hopes for a new life in America. And we'd like to hear your questions and comments as well. Do you know a Bhutanese family that lives here in the Granite State? What has your experience been in getting to know them? What more would you like to know about Bhutanese refugees, their history, their culture, and their experiences here in the Granite State? Let's get your phone calls in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email with your questions or comments at exchange@nhpr.org. or post a question at our website, nhpr.org, or on our Facebook page. We're going to take a short break right now, gentlemen, but when we come back, we'll hear more of your stories about living in refugee camps in Nepal, and then also your experiences in coming right here to the Granite State. So stay with us.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and more on the story of the Bhutanese on The Exchange on NHPR and at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, follow-up from the resignation of CIA Director David Petraeus. NHPR brings you the news every day, all year long, news from around the world, across the country, and throughout the state, breaking news, developing stories, weather and sports. NHPR, keeping New Hampshire connected. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Restaurant Week Portsmouth and the Seacoast, a 10-day culinary experience featuring 49 restaurants now through November 17th. Details at restaurantweekportsmouth.com. From Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, for any plumbing, heating, cooling, or drain problem, offering annual tune-ups and efficient heating systems, online at justcallheritage.com. And Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, welcoming author Dennis Lehane, November 27th at 7 at the Capitol Center for the Arts, postponed from an earlier date. CCANH.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the stories of Bhutanese refugees from leaving Asia to life in the Granite State. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Or send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. Our guests this hour, Tika Acharya, Executive Director and Founder of the Bhutanese Community of New Hampshire, a nonprofit that provides direct services helping with the resettlement of refugees. Narad Adhikari, who arrived in Manchester in 2011 under the resettlement program with his wife and children. And Bill Gillett, he's chairman of the International Institute of New England, a nonprofit organization that helps to resettle refugees and immigrants in the region. Gentlemen, earlier in the show, we were talking about the difficulties that you faced as the country of Bhutan put together this one people, one nation policy and how that became a direct issue for each of you. And I wanted to, Tika, pick up with your story a little bit more. You talked about your father had been arrested. He faced torture. And at one point, you thought he had been killed in while he was in custody, and you wound up leaving the country before you were even a teenager. Now, where did you wind up then after leaving Bhutan?
Well, you know, my mother appealed, you know, with my help. Obviously, I was there to, you know, to find somebody who can write an appeal to the government, and with the condition that there were a lot of, you know, as Narad already mentioned, there are army and police that came in and home, and well, you know, if you know, we had to serve them the food and everything, and then after that, well, if you'd like to have your husband released, you have to write an appeal, and then with the condition that you would like to leave the country. And by that time, many people have done that work, and then my mother opted to have, you know, her husband rather than staying and, you know, struggling, and she appealed to the government, and after 8 or 9 months, my father was released with a condition to leave the country in 72 hours.
72 hours just to leave home.
Yes. So, you know, when he was released, and then, you know, we had to leave the country in 72 hours. You know, my father had a huge amount of, he was a, you know, typically a great businessman, and used to export a lot of export business from Bhutan to Bangladesh and in India. And he had huge cash balance in the banks, had, you know, lot of properties, buildings and businesses and a renowned village. Even now, our property produces a huge amount of, you know, every year oranges and cardamoms. And so he had to leave all those things with a cash balance. And without having, you know, nothing, we had to leave in 72 hours. So we left, we came to Indian border. And there was a kind of arrangement from leaders are telling there was an arrangement from the government. And there were a truck waiting for us. And there are several families that were, you know, we made many families from different places of the country one point of time and put them in the truck. And then my father was telling, can we stay in India, because he had some connection because of his business. But nobody, listened to that, and I was not in a position to explore that opportunity. And then we went to the camp. So that was first. But later on, when camp established, my father was completely depressed and had to go for several treatment in terms of torture victims. But I had an opportunity to come to India for my studies. That's how that came up. And I was in India illegally, but I had a good opportunity to go to school and college, and I was working in India before I came here. But now and then, I was part and parcel of the refugees, in the camp. It was a border area, only 2 hours of drive from there. So I used to go in the weekends and in the vacation time and contribute to my family and at the same time to the larger community, and volunteered a lot of hours in the refugee camp. And then when a resettlement process came up, in 2007, that was a kind of United States, came up with a solution to have people apply for resettlement. And then my father talked to me, you know, and then he's willing to come to the United States if I can join with him. And I agreed and appealed to the United States then, you know, thanks United States, you know, everything went well. And, that's the whole process in early 2009 in January, where it was snowing a lot. And then we came, as I mentioned earlier, four generations. My grandmother was 88 years old. She was blind, but we got a treatment after that. She's okay now. My parents, both of my parents are disabled. My mother is disabled physically. My father is mentally. And then my wife was pregnant by that time when we came in. So that's little story.
Wow, yeah, and quite a story. Plenty on your plate there. So at one point, you were not in the camps, but you were in contact with the camps, coming
yes.
when you could and contributing, even though you were working in India over on the other side of the border from Nepal. Narad, I wanted to ask about your experience before. You had mentioned that you were working for the government and helping to translate as they implemented this One Nation, One People policy, and how difficult that was. When you left, what happened to you? You were in the camps for some time.
Yes. I was in the capital, Thimphu. I was working there, but I got the news. I couldn't visit to my parents, who were in the southern border. My father was taken to the jail. He was kept in the district headquarters, which is called Jong. So he was kept there for 3 days without food and anything. He was instantly asked to sign so-called volunteer migration form. which was written in Jonka, the national language of Bhutan, which the southern people who are of ethnic Nepali have no knowledge at all. So he was compelled to sign the so-called volunteer migration form. Like Tika says, he was given like 40 hours to prepare himself and leave from the camp. So when I heard the news that my father is leaving and he left already and he's at the border in India, I thought it's my moral responsibility to see how they are. So I came to the border, and as soon as I arrived there, I got the news from my friends that there was only one newspaper, national newspaper, called Quinzel. It was published weekly. It was a government's paper. So that published that Narad Adhikari is absconded from the country. So because of my personal security, I couldn't go back. So I have to remain with my parents and my all, everything. I was only with my one dress and just a small bag with me. And my parents were in the border. It was climatically very, very difficult for them to come in the lowland where the weather was not suitable for them. So Nepal and Bhutan, they don't have the joint border. So we heard that the government of Nepal, which has just started, the democratic government, invited the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, to open the refugee camp to provide the immediate humanitarian assistance for the refugees. So we started coming to Nepal, because the other reason why we came to Nepal is also that India is our immediate neighbor, the first country of asylum. And under 1949 Indo-Bhutan Treaty, Article 2, the foreign policy of Bhutan is also guided by India. And it was India's responsibility to provide us the shelter and then work out a suitable solution to help solve this problem. But India didn't do that of its own reason. So we have to arrive in Nepal. And in Nepal, after we arrived in Nepal in 1993, the governments of Bhutan and Nepal first opened the bilateral negotiations to solve this problem.
And Bill Gillett, the idea in establishing the camps in the eastern, southeastern part of Nepal was that this would be a temporary place where people would stay, and while those negotiations were going on, thinking this was probably not going to last terribly long. And yet, here we are in 2012, we're talking about something that started in the early 1990s. Those camps are still there, and they're still in operation, as evidenced by the fact that you were there earlier this year.
Yes, there were originally seven camps. Now, as people have been resettled, they've moved down to three camps. But the camps exist. They're very rudimentary living conditions. It's bamboo huts. There's no running water. There's no indoor plumbing, obviously. There's no limited electricity. They're fairly well run. They're well organized. But everyone in the camps basically is talking about resettlement. Where will you be next year? Where will you be? You know, when can I start my life, basically? Because they've been there for 20 years.
And we should point out, because we haven't talked about this yet, we're talking about over 100,000 refugees coming out of a country that has roughly 740 or 750,000 citizens at a time. So we're talking about a very, very large exodus of people who were forced to leave the country all at once, a huge number of people. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. We're talking about the stories of Bhutanese people in the Granite State. For the past few years, they've been New Hampshire's largest refugee group, with more arriving each year. We're exploring their journeys from nearly 20 years in refugee camps to their challenges and hopes for a new life in America. And we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. Narad, Bill Gillett said that the camps are very well organized today. Was that your experience when you were there, or did that take some time?
Well, it is many visitors, and especially the UNHCR, is telling us that these are the best organized camp. This has been possible because our people have been always peace-loving. They have been very hardworking. They want to live in peace. In Bhutan, we have been there. Bhutan is a country of diverse ethnicity, but we never have ethnic problem. We never have any religious conflict or nothing. Same in the camp, they always work hard to manage the camp because they believe that though temporarily, it is a place for them to live for a certain period of time, and we should live in a peace environment. So whoever visited, even the governments of Bhutan's official, they visited there, they welcome with the garlands. So that's the result of the refugees being very peaceful. And we spent 20 years, and still out of 108,000 refugees, we have over 40,000 living in those refugee camps, though they are now, as Bill said, they reduced the size and number of the camps.
Tika, I wanted to ask you about something that Narad brought up, which is the idea that these are peaceful people living in a camp, very well organized, hardworking, trying to make the best of the situation. I was watching a documentary that was about 5 years old called Killing Time, and it's about the situation at the camps as it existed then. And there's a person in that documentary who says something to the effect of, I'm glad that we are a peaceful people, but in a way, the fact that we have been so peaceful has made it slightly more difficult for us. If there was more violence, then maybe the world would be paying more attention. And he said, I don't want there to be more violence, but I wish that the world would pay attention to us without having to wait for there to be violence. And I'm curious what you make of that people have stayed peaceful, but almost because of that, there's a concern that there is not getting enough attention across the world for what's been happening.
Well, my experience on that is, you know, the time that refugees had to struggle for a longer period of time in refugee camp, and particularly in India and in the eastern part of, particularly in Nepal and eastern part of India, you know, the kind of moment, the political change in moment was going through, and in India, particularly Nepal, had dramatic change in, changing, government every year kind of thing. And the violence things came up, not from in the refugee camp or refugee's mind, but that has been in the environment outside. And there was a Maoist problem and kind of a successful, that has been successful for some point of time. And that, had kind of the people, particularly the youths in the refugee camp, have learned a lot from them, from outside. And they thought, okay, if we think of some violence or something like that, the solution might come. So at that point of time, and even now, people are thinking in that area. But we strongly, advise those people: violence is not a solution, and our people really, they thought about it and they went to one step to other step, but there was not significant violence that created from our community. So other reason is, the violence is one way that they have thought international community can look to the issues, which is sometimes true, because it's happening even in other developing countries, and in where there is violence in other countries like Syria and in some African countries, and they started getting the news, and they try to take that strategy to gain, to go back. That's our ultimate objective, was to go back to Bhutan in our country, and they're trying to see they have. Peacefully, they have tried their best, but people are not listening to them, and they were kind of, getting into that line. But that was for us, from other end, from the educated lot, we really discouraged that idea for a longer period of time.
Narad, I imagine in a case like these camps, where they are very well organized, it helps that they're so organized, because as people start to hear conversations about, well, maybe we could be, maybe we could start to get more attention if there was more violence. Maybe we could do what the Maoists were doing in other parts of Nepal and try to gain attention to our cause that way. That because of that organization in the camps, people could find out what was going on and start to talk to people and say, this is not the way we want to go.
Especially the youths. Before that, I would say it was very unfortunate for the Bhutanese refugee community to be resettled in a country where a huge political transition was going on. 300 years old monarchy was dethroned by the Maoist revolutionary, the fighters there. The refugees who have been always peaceful, even today, if you visit to the refugee camp and go early boarding the school, the children will be singing the national anthem of Bhutan. And the national anthem speaks all about the king's long life, good health, and good welfare of the king, not even the nation, not even the people. And so patriotic are our people still in the refugee camp. But unfortunately, when the political situation in Nepal was not very good, some of the youths got some influence. If the peaceful path is not working, Why not we also think about the other alternatives? So that could be the reason, if at all there is any logic behind that. But otherwise, it was never a choice that people should look for the alternative, go for the violence, no neighbor. People have been always, because nonviolence has been the means of solution. Dialogue has been always the means of solution. So we wanted to open the dialogue. We wanted to leave nonviolence path. We never thought of looking for any other option other than the peaceful path.
And one more question about the camps. A big part of the organization was education, that there was a huge education effort going on inside the camps for the tens of thousands of young people who were there. What did you see of that while you were living in the camps?
We really would like to thank the UNHCR and all the funding and the donor agencies. We are really committed and concentrate to promote the education, because education has been the only wealth for the refugees to carry when they go out. Because we had a lot of, not a single refugee was landless back in Bhutan. They were the landowners. They were the landlords. In the refugee camp, when they came, they didn't have anything. Like Tika says, his father had been, in the Bhutanese context, he was the millionaire. But he became penniless when he arrived in the refugee camp. That is the living example we have today. Here in the United States, not a single have been able to buy their own house. Still, they are struggling. So therefore, refugees wanted to see the solution peacefully, resume their dignified life, and live a human life like any human anywhere in the world. But refugee life has been very, very painful, insecure, very hard to live.
And we'll talk about some of the challenges of that refugee life from moving to from the camps, where many people had lived for decades, to countries like the United States and, of course, states like New Hampshire. We're talking about the stories of Bhutanese people in the Granite State today on The Exchange. We'll hear more about their journeys from nearly 20 years in refugee camps to the challenges and hopes they've had for new lives in America. We're going to take a short break right now. We'd love to get your questions and comments into the conversation. Call us at 1-800-892-6477. Again, that's 1-800-892-NHPR. Or email us exchange@nhpr.org. Coming up after the break, we'll talk about that transition to new lives here in the Granite State and what they've seen so far. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund, turning investments into loans and education to create opportunity and transform lives. CommunityLoanFund.org. And Electric Earth Concerts presenting jazz phenom Matt Savage and soprano Jana Beatty and music of the French Impressionist at 5 p.m. on the 17th at the First Church in Jaffrey. ElectricEarthConcerts.org. This is NHPR.
Virginia Prescott. Word of mouth sometimes finds new ideas coming from unexpected sources.
I think you just called me a coward.
Brandon, why did you decide to become a human guinea pig? Okay, which one of you is playing the dog?
Don't force me to swear more.
Thank you for summing it up in one sentence. I surrender to the Sinbad pants, and I am ready for Hammer Time.
Hammer Time!
Join us for more than just the usual suspects, Monday through Thursday at noon, and again at 9 p.m. on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the political and economic impact of China on the United States. Email us your questions before the show at nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, we're hearing the stories of Bhutanese refugees from leaving Asia to life in the Granite State. Join our conversation by calling 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. Our guest this hour, Tika Acharya. He's executive director and founder of the Bhutanese Community of New Hampshire, a nonprofit that provides direct services helping with the resettlement of refugees. Narad Adhikari, who arrived in Manchester in 2011 under the resettlement program with his wife and children. And Bill Gillett, he's chairman of the International Institute of New England, a nonprofit organization that helps to resettle refugees and immigrants in the region. Gentlemen, we have some callers waiting to ask some questions and bring some comments into the mix here, and we want to have Linda from Warner. She's calling. Hi, Linda. You're on The Exchange.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because when I hear about people suffering who, for no reason, and they're peace-loving people, I know that as people of good conscience, you wonder what you can do, and I'd like to give a suggestion because I have found another career. I've retired as a teacher, but I'm volunteering now at the Holy Cross Family Learning Center in West Manchester, and I teach English as a second language, and all of my students are Bhutanese, and it's an incredible, rewarding experience, and I would encourage anyone who has time, it's only a short commitment of 4 hours a week, to go in and help out at the center. The people I work with are incredibly wonderful, warm, supportive people, professional teachers. But you don't have to be a credentialed teacher to do this. You can just be a committed volunteer because any native speaker would be very welcome to come in and help tutor the students.
And Linda, let me ask you, what was it that got you to volunteer your time? What was it that got you involved with this particular community?
Well, I've always been interested in actually teaching English as a second language. I've been certified for 3 or 4 years, and I hadn't found an opportunity to serve. And I met Sister Jacqueline at a reading conference, and I just was very struck by her sense of purpose and commitment and her humanity. And I wanted to be involved in whatever she was involved in. And so once she started the center in West Manchester, which is where the refugees live, so they have access to the services, I thought, here's my chance. So I started, and I just love it. It's so rewarding. The refugees are committed. They are eager to learn. They have a wonderful sense of humor. It's the most gratifying thing I've ever done.
Let me ask you about that, Bill Gillett. Let's just talk, first of all, about the effort here in the Granite State, the kind of resources, the kind of commitment that people have made. When the International Institute first started hearing about this massive resettlement that was going to be going on for Bhutanese people, what kind of resources did you realize were going to be necessary to try and make this transition work for people as they came to the state?
Yeah, there are a number of organizations, agencies, and individuals that are part of the overall support community for refugees. The federal government provides funding, and then, as Linda pointed out, we have just people who volunteer their time, people who are engaged in a wide range of language support, workforce development, housing support, food support, and New Hampshire has done a great job of having people just come together to support this community, but actually a number of communities that have been here.
Tika, you founded the Bhutanese community of New Hampshire right here in the state. Could you first tell us about what your experience was like when you first came here and then how that led you to create this organization to try and help people as they followed the same path that you had gone down?
Well, I'd like to make a small correction. You know, it's I'm one of the founders. It's not only I who have founded. So, you know, and basically I was a founding executive director.
Okay.
So I'd like to make that correction. So as I mentioned earlier, 2009 early when I came in, we were kind of only around 12 or 13 families by that time. And now we are around 250. So that time with this 13, 14 families and, you know, very frequently coming in every day, and that the families, you know, went up, and then, you know, resettlement agency was there to help us out, but there was the, you know, the resources was limited, and we needed to have, you know, I speak a little bit of English, and you know, I was, you know, kept very busy to help people to connect, you know, with the, you know, resources available in the community. And then, you know, I along with some of the leaders, you know, in different cities, Laconia, Manchester, and Concord, we sat down, you know, one evening and thought, you know, we discussed how we can do better. And we decided to form an organization, nonprofit organization. And then from there, we went to take advice from the people, like volunteers and an expert, including Bill Gillett. And then, you know, we got positive feedback to move forward with the organization. And then we founded the organization officially in 2010 and registered as a nonprofit organization. So what we do, you know, basically the challenges for me at that point of time was, you know, the skills that we bring in, you know, here cannot be transferred so easily. We all of us bring in, you know, tremendous skills, but to make that transfer and use it in a system where there's a technology, where there is, everything which I've never thought and we have never seen. So it takes some time. And to build that capacity within our community, we felt an organization and have some resources, and that, training or any services that we provide, it's culturally and spiritually, appropriate for the people. So that makes more sense than to have a direct, service available, which is available for everybody. So we are kind of a cultural broker in between the mainstream society and the receiving community. That is the role of our organization at this point of time. And then we formed, and we do a lot of activities. Basically we started do direct services, access. So we have a staff working for the needy families to get resources. And then we moved on ESL. We provide, to selected people. We teach very, very basic people. We teach English to those who haven't even learned Nepali. So it's hard. And thank you, Linda, that's organization. We work very closely with Sister Jacqueline. And, a lot of people, including my father, they go to, Linda's class. So we work very closely with the other groups and try to bridge that gap. We are very committed in creating some resources for future in the community, that's higher education. So we guide people who are in the high school or post-high school how to get a better higher education and better colleges. So we try to help them prepare SAT and, help them prepare applications, make them ready to get. Other important piece that we work on is job ready and employment. And that's our organization work very closely with the state-owned and other private organization that they're involved in helping, not only refugees but for all low-income population. So we work with those organizations and how we can create the resources for our people and get them ready to get a job.
Let me pick up on that, okay, too. And first of all, I wanted to say, Linda, thank you for the call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Narad, when you arrived here, and you haven't been here terribly long, essentially you have organizations who are trying to help you get used to life in New Hampshire. You have services available. You have some funding when you first arrive. But then after that, you're going to need a job. You'll need a place to live. You'll need to establish a life in this state. And that can be very challenging. How have you been able to make it work?
Well, Tika is right to say that we do have a lot of skills, but that work only in the country of origin or in the refugee camp. That is not working in the country of now new home for us. So it was a big challenge for me and for the arriving new families from Bhutan. And it was very difficult for the first 6 months. The International Institute of New Hampshire, the host organization, they provided us the essential humanitarian assistance. After that, we are told that you should find a job and start your life. Both my wife and myself, we have been struggling after that, after 6 months. So that's for 1 year. We got part-time job. Sometimes we have to leave that or something happens. And currently, my wife is working with the Moore Center as a direct service provider. And myself, after the 6th of November, without job. So I'm just looking for the job.
So you're looking for a job right now. Yeah. that does illustrate one of the difficulties that at the same time that this large resettlement has been going on here and across the country, then there's also there's this economic downturn that the United States has been facing as a whole. Let's bring another caller in. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Doug is calling from Loudoun. Hi, Doug. You're on the exchange.
Hi, how are you?
Very good.
I want to call and make a comment that I enjoy hearing what you're talking about today and the fact that we as a wholesale greenhouse in Loudoun, we've been working with the number of Bhutanese refugees that are here, and it's just been a great experience for us. We've had quite a few work for us the last couple of years. Unfortunately, we can't always keep them busy all year, but we're looking forward to the winter when we get busy, and we'll be bringing a lot of them back if they're interested. And as a matter of fact, we have so many applications from the Bhutanese community. We wish we could take them all because there's some great workers, and we do have a number of them that have been with us year-round for a few years now, and we can't say enough good things about the whole work ethic that they bring to us.
Doug, thanks so much for the call. Tika, that's a vote of confidence right there, an employer in New Hampshire saying these are people who come to the state looking for work and ready to work, and that's exactly music to his ears, it sounds like.
That's great, and thank you, Doug, for getting us here and having other people hear about the employer's experience. And we have people, and I mentioned 250 families right now, and there are some families who are not employable in the sense they are disabled or elder, and some people having some struggles. But in an average, each member of the family of at least 200 families, at least one member are working. And the kind of feedback that we have got from the employers is tremendous, particularly in work ethic, which is very, very important skills that an employer is looking for. And then when you think about, average, these persons, they earn around $20,000 to $25,000 a year. So do a little calculation with 200. It comes around $5 million. And where does money go? We spend in Granite State. So indirectly, we already started contributing to the community, to the economy. So, and then there are people who are buying houses, starting their new businesses, and there are all the good things. The only thing is, in the initial state, is a challenge, and for that, we really need help, and from the host community, to help like people like Linda, like Doc, and there are many people who are helping us, and we need more people to help us out. And they can also access our office, Bhutanese Community of New Hampshire, in 510 Chestnut Street with the phone number 232-1829.
And we'll put that information up on our website as well.
Yeah.
Doug, thanks so much for that call. The exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Let's see if we can get one more call in here. Beth is calling from Bedford. Hi, Beth. You're on the exchange.
Thank you. Very interesting program. I had just a question, and maybe I should know this, but as refugees, what do these Bhutanese people, what is their path to citizenship?
It's a fascinating question, Beth, and I'm going to turn that over to Bill Gillett.
Yeah, when the refugees come here, they are eligible for their green card, they become permanent residents, and they are on the same path to citizenship that any immigrant on that path would be. So it's 5 years to citizenship. And, of course, you have to meet the requirements of being able to speak English and have a historical knowledge of the United States.
Great question, Beth. Tika, I wanted to ask you, now that you've been here, that question comes up for you. What do you think you're going to do? Are you going to try and apply for citizenship? Or
I it's 4 years now. It will be 4 years in January. So I'm hoping to get my citizenship in 2013, and I'll be a voter. And along with me will be around in next time. This time we couldn't make it. But next time we'll be having, at least I expect, around 3,000 voters in New Hampshire.
And does that pose any questions? And I'll ask this to both you and to Narad. Do you have any sort of conflict inside about that feeling, okay, I'm taking citizenship now, I'm going to become a citizen of the United States, but really I'm only here because of the difficulty in a country that I never really intended to leave in the first place? Does that feel strange in any way?
You want to take that?
The government and the people of the United States are the main, today, leading all over the world for democracy, peace, and development. And this country has accepted and recognized the dual citizenship. Even if I become citizens today, here, I look forward, with the help of the people of this great country, that we would be able to go back to Bhutan, and we'll also have the citizenship in Bhutan. Both the citizens will be recognized and respected so that we can contribute for both the countries. Now, we are not only concerned and interested about Bhutan, we are equally concerned and interested about the national interests of this great country. So I believe that would be honored in the due course of time.
So that's the way to strike the balance then.
Brady, I will say, talking to a number of the leaders of the Bhutanese community, what they've recognized at this point is if there is a hope of them returning to Bhutan, it is going to need to be led by the United States, because it is only this country that really has the moral authority to make the case and to take that forward in the international community with Bhutan.
Yes.
How much time do you each get to spend, talking about striking balances, you have those immediate needs of the people who are here, who are looking for jobs, who are looking for housing, who are looking for community services. And then how much time do you get to spend trying to push for that big change so that there can be changes in Bhutan so that someday you may be able to come back?
Well, you know, but every people have the passion to do something in life. So since, you know, we are born in Bhutan, we love our country, and we cannot just forget, even if we are in a developed nation. And then, you know, think of those families and the struggle that people in Bhutan are struggling in camps, people. So we'd like to contribute back to our community so that we would be able to, you know, support them. So we'll definitely take some time out in a week to talk, discuss, and try to network and get some opportunities to contribute to our people back home.
Well, I guess we're going to have to leave it right there as we're out of time. I want to thank each of you for coming in and talking with us. Narad Adhikari, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It is a great pleasure and honor for me.
Narad Adhikari arrived in Manchester in 2011 under the resettlement program with his wife and children. Tika Acharya, thank you so much.
My pleasure, and I hope that, you know, we'll keep getting this opportunity to talk in future.
We will stay in touch. Tika Acharya is Executive Director and Founder of the Bhutanese Community of New Hampshire, a nonprofit that provides direct services helping with the resettlement of refugees. And Bill Gillick, great to see you as well.
Thank you, Brady, and thank you to The Exchange for its long history with respect to immigration issues.
Bill Gillick, Chairman of the International Institute of New England. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoy. The views